Okay, so first off, I'm supposed to have
you... You want me to hold it?
I'll hold it.
Okay.
Can you say your name and title, and do we have permission to broadcast and edit this interview?
Yes, my name is Franklin S. for Shoichiro Odo, O-D-O. I'm director of the Asian Pacific American Program here at the Smithsonian Institution, and yes, you have permission to use this.
So I'm going to start out with the topic of harsh labor conditions. Can you talk about global migration and the larger context of the 1800s, which saw many peasants or laborers leaving their home country to earn money abroad? So not only to the U.S., but also like other colonial powers.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, there's a lot of labor migration going on at the time. And the specific particular groups that come to Hawaii because they're not part, for example, of the French Empire or the British Empire, where you have Indians going to the Caribbean or to Africa, for example. So the Chinese first and then the Japanese and then Koreans and Filipinos happen to fall in a geographic sector that isn't colonized by anybody else in Europe. And so that helps explain which particular groups come to Hawaii. This is happening all over the world, partly as a result of industrial agriculture having taken root. So plantation cultivation taking place in the American South, which accounts for slavery, African slavery, or the Caribbean plantations, tobacco, rum, sugar, and tea, and coffee, and cocoa. All of these kinds of plantation kinds of commodities require large numbers of cheap labor. And so that's the overall framework within which this takes place.
So let's focus on the labor conditions. Beechert says that the labor conditions are not oppressive, yet many workers describe the work like slavery.
Yeah.
So how would you describe plantation labor conditions from the beginning? And then how and why did these conditions evolve? Mm-hmm.
Well, the first workers recruited were native Hawaiians. And what the planters found was that they weren't reliable, partly because they could run away and go home. And they could find places of refuge, and so they were not a good controllable labor force. But to the question about Beechert's comment, you know, I think what he means to say by that is that it wasn't as oppressive as, say, conditions in the Caribbean or in Africa or Southeast Asia or parts of Fiji, for example, where from a comparative point of view, they're not as horrible. But from the point of view of the people being brought from China or Japan or Korea, the conditions were very bad. I would say oppressive is a useful term to describe conditions where people could barely make enough money to send some back to their families in Asia, where the gender imbalance was so huge that you had, prostitution rampant, gambling, social disorders that were extremely difficult for the primarily male workforce to survive. So yeah, I would say oppressive is a pretty good term.
And can you just describe those conditions? Like, what was it like to work?
If you do that, you need to take a look from the 1850s to the 1880s to the early 1900s. Things get gradually better as there are strikes, as people desert, as the plantation owners and managers understand that they have to maintain minimum levels of comfort and stability for the workers so that they actually have a reason to stay. So early plantation history is rife with stories of desertions and the planters using detectives and a police force to try to track these folks down.
And why were they deserting? I mean, what was so harsh about the work?
The labor itself, sugar plantation work was very harsh. Long hours, 6 days a week, low pay, and coerced workforce. I mean, they were the lunas or managers, the straw bosses, were not constrained from using physical force. So using whips and so on was something that may not have been common, but was certainly always at the beck and call of the managers. So, and the workers understood this. They knew they were subject to physical abuse if that became useful to management. And there was no union, there was no recourse to anything but running away if conditions got really bad.
And can you describe the living conditions?
Some. The earliest, when we look at photographs coming, you know, going back to the 1870s and 1880s, for example, and I know the Japanese-American labor conditions the best, because that's what I studied most intensely. And that begins 1868. The Chinese are there primarily before then. but the early plantation housing was shacks, basically, that were hardly better than habitations for animals. So it was pretty bad. And those eventually evolved into barrack-like buildings that, for example, housed into the 1880s, you had long row houses type of buildings that had bunks like shelves that ran all the way around the rooms and stacked three or four high. So you had one section of the barrack being used as a kitchen, and so people would cook there, and then move down the hall to sleep on these. Really, they look like shelves, and they, as I say, they might be stacked two or three or four high, and these would house couples as well as individual men. So sometimes, as a favor, they'd let the married couples have the lowest bunk there. And if you can think about having babies who cry, and so there are stories of mothers who would have to take their babies if they got up at night and were crying, because the men had to get their sleep, and so they would force the women to take the child out into the sugarcane until the baby calmed down. Mm-hmm. So I'd say these are pretty bad conditions.
And what would like a day in the life of a laborer be like?
Labor was highly stratified, and you had. The reason I'm hesitating is, you know, what kind of a laborer? One of the things that the Japanese government insisted upon in 1886, before the first major group of workers were allowed to come to Hawaii, was that there be a minimum of 20% of the workers be women. Excuse me. Let me just get a drink of water.
Okay, so
as I was saying, if you take, for example, a woman laborer in the 1890s, let's just say, to be fairly specific, you would have probably come as a married woman. Your husband was probably also a laborer on a sugar plantation. So you would have one or more children. You yourself would be either be employed, or you would be earning money by cooking for other workers or caring for other children. So you would be working. Every woman, found herself employed in one form or another. So then, if your husband was a worker and you were, for example, also in the plantations employ, then you'd probably get up about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and you'd cook. You'd cook for your children. You'd cook for your husband. You'd cook for yourself to take lunch out to the cane field, and then you'd cook for breakfast, right? And then you'd go out and work. And the typical day would start at 6 in the morning and end at about 4:30 or so, and with maybe 15 minutes or 20 minutes for lunch. And then you come back and then you'd start cooking dinner, and you'd take care of the babies, and then you'd clean up, and then you'd go to bed, probably at 10 or 11, which means you'd be getting 4 hours of sleep. So the men folk, on the other hand, would be getting up maybe at 5, having breakfast, going off to the fields, working. And the likelihood is that they'd be doing harder labor. Although this was not always true, there were women who were also doing jobs like carrying the cut cane to the flumes or where the ox carts or wherever the transportation system was that took the cane from the fields to the mills. So it wasn't always true that the women had easier jobs. But by and large, this was the case. So it depends, as I say, on where you were, what you were doing. And among the men, cutting the cane, carrying the cane, these were the kinds of jobs that were the most difficult. But they, as I say, they worked 6 days a week. And so Sundays was, you know, were their only days off.
Can you describe what was provided for under the early labor contracts? What did the plantations agree to provide?
Housing.
Can you, when I ask
the
question...
Oh, right, I'm sorry.
Can you try to use the question in
right,
your answer?
Right, thanks. Well, some of the conditions that obtained on different plantations allowed for workers to receive different kinds of goods and services from the plantations. In the earlier contracts, the plantations provided housing, fuel for cooking, and sometimes some medical care. And the medical care was very uneven, to say the least.
What does that mean?
Well, there might be a plantation doctor in a plantation, but that doctor was working for the plantation, which means that his job might well be described as trying to get the workers to work. So if a worker came into his office and said, "Doc, I'm really not feeling well today. I need to stay home and rest." And the doctor would look at the person and say, "You look fine to me. You know, get on your feet and get out to work."
Can you describe the paternalism in terms of labor and how it is utilized by management?
Sure. Paternalism was a very important part of management control, because in general, it's difficult to only use the stick to try to control a labor force. Some carrots were necessary, and so trying to provide for somewhat better housing, making sure that there was rice rather than potatoes. You know, some of those kinds of accommodations were made to try to keep the plantation labor force more satisfied. Later in the 1900s, as the plantations required second generation Nisei in the Japanese American labor force to become part of the labor pool, partly because after 1900, when Hawaii becomes part of the United States after the 1898 annexation, then the ability to generate immigrants diminishes as more exclusion acts are passed by the United States Congress, the Gentleman's Agreement and so on, begin to reduce the plantation's ability to bring in as many different kinds of workers as they want, then it becomes more important to provide a different level of paternalism. So, for example, whereas with the immigrants, plantations might provide plots of land for a Buddhist church or a cemetery that had some ways in which the ethnic-specific cultural practices might be utilized, or as the second generation was being born, to provide land for schools, for Japanese language schools, those kinds of things, they could do. And as the kids grew up, to provide a playground, to provide baseball fields for the kids to play on. So that kind of paternalism was very, very important to making sure that they tried to keep some kind of stability in the labor force.
Dime threw this question in. She wanted to know what paternalism's relationship was to the Hawaiian hierarchy that was already in place before the plantations. And she's been doing some other reading than me, so maybe does that resonate with you?
To the native Hawaiian? By the time the immigrant labor force becomes a significant part of the plantation system, the older forms of native Hawaiian cultural practices, the native Hawaiian cultural practices with the hierarchy, I think are not particularly relevant, that it's really a white haole kind of a controlled stratification. So the native practices are seen, I think, with intra-working class relationships. A lot of the immigrants saw very little of the white managers and owners, but they were in touch with other ethnic group workers and with Native Hawaiians.
Okay. So we were just talking about labor conditions and living conditions. How did these conditions play out for each successive wave of immigrants from different countries? Like you talked about the Chinese coming first and then the Japanese. So when each new group came in, did they inherit, did each group kind of graduate up to a better level and then the new wave inherited what was previously there? How did that work?
By and large, it was true that subsequent groups inherited slightly better conditions. But there are a lot of exceptions to this rule. For example, when Europeans were first recruited in about 1900, there were Puerto Ricans who were recruited from Puerto Rico. There were even Californians who came in 1900. And those people were generally provided, much better, qualitatively better conditions than either the Chinese or Japanese who came before them or Koreans and Filipinos who came after them. So there was a sort of a skin color privilege that obtained, including with a number of Portuguese who were incorporated into the system in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to move into labor resistance. What were some early forms of labor resistance?
Workers always have some way in which to resist an inequitable treatment or treatment that they consider to be oppressive. Sometimes it was simply not working on the job or doing as little as possible. I'm sure that there was a lot of that. So this whole thing of looking at Asians or Asian Americans as always being energetic and doing their work properly and all is certainly not true. So that was one of the forms that took. Organized resistance by asking somebody to become a leader of this in pre-union times, that is anything before, well, the 1940s. So anything up to that point would have been very sporadic. But you could have just a group of workers who went up to a supervisor and said, look, this is, you're trying to make us work too fast. This is, we need a break. We need to get some water or whatever. Those kinds of things always took place.
And can you bring up some other examples of individual acts of resistance?
Oh, sure. There were people who would either ambush in a group or fight back against a supervisor, pull somebody off a horse and beat him up, or those kinds of things took place. And sometimes what happened, those individuals understood that in committing that kind of random act of violence, that they would become hunted, targeted by law enforcement, by the other goons that the plantations employed. So those are often the folks who then had to desert. And in the Japanese community, there were known areas of refuge, specific places like Kona on the Big Island or Waimanalo on Oahu, where individuals knew that if they got there, that they would be provided refuge. They would be provided an alias, a false name, and allowed to be incorporated into that community. So people knew that.
And was that a native community or like?
Another Japanese American community.
Oh, so those were folks who had graduated off of the plantation?
Right. Or.
Can you state that?
I'm sorry. There, while the vast majority of workers imported were imported for plantation use, there always were pockets of individuals who were doing other things. For example, in the Japanese American community, you had people who were barbers or independent farmers or houseboys or doing other kinds of work that might have been required to maintain the community from birth to death, midwives to people who ran mortuaries. So you had a community that might have had enough size and complexity so that people who deserted from a particular plantation might be able to find a refuge in one of those communities, like Kona or Waimanalo.
Huh, interesting. So if those were sort of individual acts of resistance,
yes,
like desertion, work slowdowns, can you talk about what makes the 1920 strike and the 1946 strike significant in contrast?
Sure. In the first large, there are lots of strikes that take place on one plantation, one ethnic group, one incident throughout the period of plantation labor. And it's really only in 1909 that you get an organized strike by an entire ethnic group, and in this case is Japanese Americans, the Japanese, by and large, the Japanese immigrant population, which struck the plantations on Oahu. So the other Japanese workers on the other islands continued working. So it wasn't a total strike of the territory. So that's different. It's a significantly different sort of event because it's organized at least on an island-wide basis by all the people who came from Japan. But it doesn't include other people, and it doesn't include people on the neighbor islands. 1920 is often seen as a different kind of animal because for a time there was a partnering and communication between the Japanese strikers and the Filipino workers. But it didn't last very long, and it was very easily, the Filipinos were easily broken away from the Japanese. And part of the way in which plantation owners, the press, the territorial legislators, the ability to drive those two groups apart, relied on a lot of state power, the territorial government, the law enforcement officials, everybody else, really acted together in this sort of hegemonic power structure that made it very difficult for the Filipinos to stay with the Japanese, and they left pretty quickly.
Well, I asked you this before, but what do you think? What do you feel are the two major labor? What are the two key moments in labor organizing and plantation history?
The two key points in time in plantation labor history probably are 1909 and 1946. 1909 because it's the first concerted strike, which brings together workers from different plantations, at least on one island. But it's only one ethnic group. And it's not until 1946 that you get a successful union-led organized strike that takes place across the territory that brings together a working class consciousness and employs that specifically with their communities to effect a successful strike.
So let's talk about 1909 first then. What led up to a strike happening by the Japanese workers?
I think 1909 happens partly because the workers are involved with family creation. There are, as I mentioned earlier, the Japanese are the only Asian group that is brought with significant numbers of women. And the Japanese government insists on it, and the planters agree because they both feel this is a way of stabilizing the community so that you don't have the kinds of things that were alleged to be happening with the Chinese workers. That is, huge unbalanced gender ratios that encouraged, if not forced, things like prostitution, alcohol, drug abuse, and all the rest of it, gambling. So the more stable community life was seen as a way to provide for a more stable workforce. What I think was an unintended consequence was that stable community life meant more babies and families being formed. And the families being formed meant that the wage structures that permitted single men or couples without children to survive on barely adequate wages, out of which they sent some portion back home to their families, and then were able to save some in order to return to Japan or go on to the United States or whatever they wanted to do, quickly became inadequate, because then they had to buy clothes for the children. They had to pay for teachers for their language schools. They had to do all sorts of things that required capital. And so what used to be adequate in what we would call inadequate, but used to be adequate at least to maintain body and soul, quickly became inadequate for these families and communities. So by 1909, you could really see this happening. And the workforce understood that they had to stand and make, show some solidarity for this. The other part, I think, is that by the early 1900s, and certainly by 1909, the nationalistic sense of pride in being Japanese, a consciousness of coming from a country, coming from a race, as they saw it, that was rapidly modernizing. And not only modernizing vis-a-vis other parts of Asia, but by 1909, Japan had defeated Russia in a war. And by 1909, Japan had begun making significant inroads into colonizing Korea. So the Japanese were thinking and being told, telling themselves, that they were coming from a superior race. And so they objected mightily to being treated like other Asians. So there was that kind of leadership communication going on, discussions with the homeland, a sense that they ought to be treated differently and that they deserve to be treated with more respect.
So what were the demands of the strikers?
In 1909, the strikers really, I think, were looking for slightly better wages, that kept up with inflation, less work hours, less diversion in pay between men and women, for example, and better conditions in terms of housing.
And then what were their tactics and how did that end up playing out?
The leaders of the 1909 strike were pretty much intellectuals among the immigrant generation, and they saw themselves as leading a group of relatively uneducated workers. So there was a gap between the leaders of the strike, who were communicating with the plantations, and the workers themselves, and that eventually proved to be a difficult gap to overcome. I'm sorry, what was
what were their tactics? Because you were saying that this was the first island-wide strike. So how was that coordinated, and how were they trying to? What were they trying? Yeah. How were they trying to beat the planters? And I had also heard that, like, although Japanese on the other islands continued to work, that they were contributing to the strike fund. So could you kind of go over
all
of that?
Sure. Okay. In the 1909 strike, the Japanese community was communicating within itself in highly organized fashion. The newspapers were pretty well established by then. You had folks being able to travel among the islands. So there were strike dues that were taken up. The strike was essentially withholding their labor was the way that they wanted the plantations to agree to terms, and the strategy was to strike all of the major plantations on Oahu, shut them down, and keep the neighbor island plantations working, partly so that their compatriots on the neighbor islands would continue to earn their salaries and be able to support the strikers. So the plantations, in retaliation, of course, for one thing, kicked all the workers out of their housing on the because that was one of the things that they provided. So they were forced out of their homes and onto the streets. And so that was one of the things that the leaders had to understood that was going to happen. So they had to make accommodations with people who were living on Oahu, other Japanese, to provide space for them, to create tent conditions, to create other communities, and provide for huge kitchens, for example, to feed all of these people. And they had established groups that were became fish. The fishermen provided fish. The rice growers provided the rice. Doctors provided free medical care, since the plantations weren't doing that. So there were medical personnel within the community who helped the strikers and their families. And there were people who were hunters would go out into the woods and hunt wild pigs or deer or pheasant or whatever birds. And And the fairly organized community of grocers, for example, and export-import community members would provide canned goods or food or miso or other kinds of foodstuffs that came from Japan.
And then in 1909, that can you talk about the what else the planters did besides evict them from their plantation homes? How did the planters respond?
Well, the planters, in 1909, the planters were able to utilize a wide variety of tactics to try to break the strike, in which they did, without actually too much trouble, I think. The workers, you know, were pretty valiant about trying to carry on their work, but one of the things the planters did was to hire strikebreakers at Koreans, Chinese, Native Hawaiians, and begin really systematically bringing more Filipinos in to break the strike. So that was one thing, to create an alternative workforce that could work the fields. A second tactic was to use law enforcement to harass the strikers, harass their families. So controlling the state apparatus was another way. A third way was to try to get the other communities to see that the Japanese were not an economic force, but a national force. So to use nationalism and racism as a major tactic. So the newspapers, for example, uniformly painted, the white newspapers uniformly painted the Japanese strike as being directed from Tokyo and as an advance guard of the Japanese who were plotting to take over the territory, and not as a group of workers trying to better their own conditions.
And with the point that you brought up earlier about Japanese feeling nationalistic pride, mm-hmm. And a sense of like that they're better than other Asians, how valid do you think that argument is?
Well, the planters and the newspaper editors and writers, for example, understood, I think, that this was a working class movement, and not a plot guided from Japan to infiltrate and then take over Hawaii for Japan's purposes. I think this was a cynical kind of use of the nationalism and pride of race that already existed. So it was manipulating the sentiment and the kinds of expressions of nationalism that the Issei, the Japanese immigrants, had, rather than really feeling that there was a threat coming from across the Pacific.
And my understanding is that although the workers lost the strike, that many of the demands that they made were given, that the planters gave in shortly thereafter, but yet there was this sense that the planters wouldn't give in during the strike. So could you kind of talk about that?
Yes, I think it was very important for the planters in 1909 to break the strike first and not discuss terms with the workers, to basically invalidate the organization that existed driving the strikers. Later, and particularly after the strike was indeed broken, the planters could then, in their own form of paternalism, then acquiesce to some of the conditions and pay scales that the workers had been demanding in the first place.
And I just want to go back over a couple of the details, especially with regard to the ethnicities that were immigrating. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what percentage of the labor force was Japanese at that time? And then you talked about Chinese, Native Hawaiians, and then Filipinos being brought in as strikebreakers. So why didn't they continue that multi-ethnic importation, or mm-hmm. were they?
Yeah, you know, I don't recall offhand the precise percentages, but let's say by 1900, the Chinese Exclusion Act had been passed by Congress in 1882. So as part of the United States, it became impossible to recruit more Chinese to come into the plantations. The native population had already been decimated. I mean, it was even if they were able to recruit from there, there just weren't that many people left to recruit from. So those two early sources of cheap labor no longer existed. And as I say, the planters were constrained by the global nature of labor recruitment, so that where the French were able to had controlled Southeast Asia, or the Dutch Indonesia, or the British South Asia, those areas were off limits to American planters. So the two subsequent areas later, if we exclude for a moment the places like Portugal, the Azores, or even California, where some people had been recruited, those areas included individuals who came from white or European countries, where the whole racial profiling didn't permit for forced labor at that level. In the case of Hawaii, the places open to them were places like Korea for a small period of time. And it's really, and the Korea situation, which begins in 1903 with systematic recruitment, ends with only about 7,000 Koreans who are recruited, largely because Japan colonizes Korea. And because the Japanese government sees that the Koreans are being used against their own subjects in Hawaii, they simply refuse to permit the Koreans to leave.
So what is the lesson that the workers learned at the close of the 1909 strike? Well, for both of them, what did the workers learn and what did the planters learn?
Okay. After the 1909 strike ends, I think, the planters learn that the workers have the capability of organizing along ethnic lines with fairly considerable skills, so that they're not they need to be taken a little bit more seriously. The planters learn that they can use community pressure, propaganda, use of the newspapers, and so on, that race is a highly potent and volatile form of pressure that can be used to divide the workers, Filipinos from Japanese, Koreans, and so on. They learn that some form of communication is probably useful. They learn that they can be proactive in providing some levels that will help to prevent complete worker dissatisfaction, improving conditions in housing, and so on. The workers learn that they have some power. They learn that they don't need to depend on a small group of outside intellectuals within their community, for one thing. They learn that it's important to try to partner with other ethnic groups to try to get a broader united front. I think those are the major things that they learn.
So can you talk, can you give some more examples of the ways that planters used race as a divide, used ethnicity as a way to divide the workers?
I think the way the planters use race and it's pretty consistent in 1909, 1920, and through the 20s and 30s, is to target the group that is going on strike, and to come and to obfuscate. They complicate the issue by disguising it as a race issue rather than a work or employment or wage issue, and to point to their to the homeland as a threat, in this case, Japan.
I mean, kind of more on a broad scale, because we haven't talked about the separate, how the camps were separated into different ethnic groups or like different wage scales. Mm. So can you talk about it on a larger scale in terms of how the planters divided the races?
Mm-hmm. There is some controversy over the degree to which race is employed to divide and rule, divide and conquer on the plantations. I think some of the disparities in wage scales, for example, come organically out of the fact that there are the groups that are the most recently arrived get placed in sections of the camp that are racially segregated, for example, that look like they're racially segregated, but it may be true that this is not necessarily a divide and rule tactic, that in fact immigrant groups prefer to be with one another, that you would set up housing in a different section rather than one that's already occupied, for example, by Chinese or Japanese who are already working on the plantations. So while it's clear to me that the planters have a very good sense that ethnicity, nationality, race are useful organizing concepts by which to keep the labor force disunited, it's not clear to me that setting up wage scales or segregating camps is part of that whole scheme. I think it flows, as I say, I think it flows organically from when people come in and where they're placed, and it fits with the concept that keeping the force separated is useful. But I don't know that it is a first organizing principle.
Okay. How are you doing?
Okay.
Okay, we'll keep going. Well, going from 1909 to 1946 is a big leap, huh?
Yes, yeah. So we can talk about 1920s, 1920, 1924. I think it's useful to go from 1909 to talk a little bit about 1920, and then to talk about 1924 and the 1930s, when the Filipinos take the lead in organizing strikes. And I know specifically that in the 24 strike on Kauai and in the 30s on Maui, that the Filipino strikes are certainly not supported by the Japanese community. And I think this is partly because they see 1920 as having been a case in which the Filipinos deserted them and abandoned that project. So they don't see why they should particularly respond to Filipinos. They also see the Filipinos as inferior, and so not necessarily anybody to work with. But I think the 1920 strike is devastating. I know other people have written about it in a different kind of way, that this is the harbinger of change and pro-union work and so on. But I think for 2 decades, the Japanese American community has been defeated. I mean, it feels defeated.
Well, can you summarize 1920 for me?
The 1920 strike it begins with a great deal of enthusiasm. There's unity largely between the second generation workers born in Hawaii, and the Ise, men and women who are still working in the fields. it's as much a worker-led strike as it is an intellectual-driven one. So there's a lot of enthusiasm for it. there's a lot of hope that the inter-ethnic, international, interracial union can work. This turns out to be largely untrue within a couple of months. So the legacy is one of failed kind of optimism, where people had thought that maybe things would be different this time around, I think.
Well, can you just go over the nuts and bolts of what happened, like what led up to it, and how did the distrust set in, and then what was the outcome of the strike?
The strike, the 1920 strike actually begins technically with the Filipino Union beginning a walkout against the wishes of the Japanese union leadership, which had asked for a simultaneous opening of the strike itself. And on the Japanese side, a lot of the planning had taken place in Buddhist churches, in among the American educated youth. So there was a lot of work going on independent of one another. And then some modicum of communication between the Japanese and the Filipinos. The planters very skillfully, I think, used the division and targeted the Filipino leadership and created the conditions which pretty much mandated that the Filipinos would abandon the strike. And so the Filipinos were certainly one of the characterizations of the Filipino community was that it was largely male. It didn't have the kind of community infrastructure that could provide for continuity. For example, the doctors and nurses, the hunters, the fishermen, the stores, all that infrastructure that the Japanese American community had, even in 1909, Filipinos didn't have in 1920. So it was much easier to fracture the Filipino leadership and the community. So essentially that's what happened, that the planters were able to sow the seeds of discontent within the Filipino union and convince the workers that their leadership was fraudulent, and then convince the leadership to disavow the relationship with the Japanese and go back to work. And still it took the Japanese community, the Japanese workers lasted something like 6 months anyway. So it was a pretty prodigious effort. And I think that the community expended a lot of its energy and capital in that effort. And it was sort of like an all-out effort that failed. And so it was very difficult to get them going again for decades.
Well, can you talk about specifically what kind of support the community offered, and was that shared with the Filipino community? And then can you describe more about the distrust? Like what was the way specifically that they felt betrayed by the Filipino community?
Well, the Filipino community itself in 1920 was not, as I said, not a sophisticated community in the sense of having an infrastructure of people. There were not that many women, for example. So you didn't have communities with families. You didn't have the whole midwives to mortuaries community structure that the Japanese enjoyed. So it was much more difficult for the Filipinos to really think about how they would work on the strike as a long-term project. The Japanese had 1909 as an example. So they had a long history of working together trying to better conditions for work on the plantation. The Filipinos were not that fortunate. So what the planters did with the Filipinos was to sow the seeds of distrust by talking about having bribed the Filipino leadership, for example. And that may or may not have been true. It's hard to know from this vantage point in time. But it was widely believed. And so that was a major way, if not the major way. And the Japanese community, people were not sophisticated enough to be able to say, we're in this together and for any length of time. So it was not that difficult to drive a wedge between the two groups.
And was there shared support between them?
Not a lot. Okay. I mean, I think this is an area that hasn't been studied very well. I think in the very early parts of the strike in 1920, there was a lot of goodwill on both sides, and there was an attempt to try to share resources. But I think that broke down pretty quickly.
So the distrust on the Japanese side was that the labor leadership sold out.
Yes, I think that was reported in the press. I mean, press controlled by the plantation circles. By the time you get into the first month of the strike in 1920, it's pretty clear that there are rumors that the Japanese workers are being fed at least stories that the Filipino leadership has sold out.
As the 1920 strike, you say, really devastated the Japanese community, it sounds like it helped the Filipino community start to organize, because then you mentioned other strikes mm-hmm. that the Filipino community had. So can you kind of talk about that transition in labor organizing power?
Well, I think that the 1920 strike really does devastate the Japanese worker community. I don't think that leads to Filipino leadership of a working class movement, because the groups are pretty much separated. So the Filipinos are organizing themselves out of the same kind of imperatives that created the 1920 strike. They come from a country that is colonized by the United States. They're receiving basically an American education until the point in time at which they come to the United States as workers. So they think of themselves largely, I'm not sure about this, but I think that they have a sense of themselves as American, that they are entitled in a way to being treated better than they are, and being treated better than Koreans or Chinese or Japanese, because you know they're part of the United States, and so there is that, along with the fact that they're given the worst jobs and the worst housing and so on. So they have all those things there, and plus then where the Japanese had a kind of a nationalistic pride in a rising nation state from which they had come, the Filipinos had a growing sense of entitlement out of their sense of being a part of the United States. And so those two things come together to propel, I think, the Filipino workers into demanding better treatment and wages.
And so how does that lead us to 1924?
The fact that after 1920, the planters don't in fact treat the Filipinos with any respect, and don't in fact do very much better by them with wages and treatment. I think that, coupled with the growing sense of being part of the United States and therefore deserving a better treatment, I think combines to get to the strikes like 1924. or 1930s, where they don't even try, at least as far as I understand, they don't even try to forge racial or inter-ethnic strategies.
Okay. How are you doing?
Okay.
We're only up to 1946. Okay, so how did global politics and economics affect the labor movement and plantation life between 1920 and 1946? I mean, I'm thinking
that's
about
a big question.
The Depression and World War One, and then World War Two, and then the ILWU coming in. So maybe you can take it piece by piece.
Okay, trying to. I mean, I think it's important to put Hawaii plantation history in a global context, and that's why I say, even before 1909, the rising sense of nationalism among Japanese workers is heightened by Japan's victories in military conflict with China in 1895, and then Russia in 1904-5, and then colonizing Korea in 1910. The First World War is important to 1920, because in that period, a lot of people made money. Wars are bad for many people, but they're good for some folks. Some people, like Halliburton. I mean, some people make a lot of money in conflicts. So by the time you get to 1919, when most of the war is over, the First World War, the workers certainly know that the plantations have made a great deal of money. Sugar became a highly useful product and one that was very much valued, and so the planters made a lot of money in World War One. So the workers could see this, and they knew. In fact, they knew some of the figures, because some of the figures were open, and the information was open to the public, and so their outcry was one of in addition to the long litany of injustices that they had endured, look at all the money you're making. Why can't you share some of that? By the time the Filipino strike of 1924 takes place, the major, I think, international issue is rising tension between the United States and Japan. Among other things, the United States has concluded the London Treaty that allows for parity of warships being built by the United States and London, and relegating Japan to a second-tier nation. And while it was a second-tier nation by the 1920s, it was aspiring to first-tier leadership in the world. So Japan, as a nation and as a modernizing country, deeply resented the United States. And so that was a tension that was going on between the United States and Japan, which affected the Japanese immigrants. The Filipinos, on the other hand, I mean, the Koreans, of course, by the time you get to 1920, the Korean March 1919 attempt, I don't know what you call it, uprising, in protest of Japanese colonization, has failed, been stamped out by the Japanese military. There are Korean workers who are chomping at the bit to try to help reclaim Korean independence from Japan. So some of them are actually training as military in the sugarcane fields. I mean, they're actually doing military drills, looking forward to the day that when they can go home to fight and be in combat against the Japanese. So there's really strong antagonisms between the Koreans and the Japanese being played out in Hawaii. But the Koreans are such a small number, no more than 7,000 at its largest. So the Korean community is not very influential.
Mm-hmm. And what was going on with the U.S. labor movement that then influenced the Hawaii plantation labor movement?
Well, the United States labor movement is really largely irrelevant to Hawaii until the ILWU begins its attempt to try to unionize first the docks and then the plantations. But this doesn't happen until the late 30s, and not very successfully at first.
Well, when and how do the plantation workers unionize?
The ILWU, the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union, is a union of seamen and people who work on the docks. So that that union, based in San Francisco, consciously attempts to try to organize the workers on the docks in Honolulu, because that's a very important part of the trade that goes on, in particular the sugar trade that goes on between Hawaii and the West Coast. So the ILWU, based in San Francisco, sends its organizers, and they begin successfully organizing the longshoremen on the docks in Honolulu and to a certain extent in Hilo by the mid to late 30s. In fact, there is a significant what is sometimes called the Hilo Massacre in 1938, when armed law enforcement officials shoot a number of longshoremen and their families who are on the docks peacefully protesting the use of scabs. But it's not, and the war, World War II, prohibits the ILWU from organizing openly. But in many ways, I think World War II is a major step in weakening the Big Five, the Hawley oligarchy, the stranglehold that had characterized the white leadership in Hawaii, because that leadership depended on control of the sugar plantations, number one, the pineapple plantations, then all the infrastructure that came with it, the government, the courts, the law enforcement, the financial institutions, the banks, insurance companies, the construction firms, the utilities, everything. So that if a dissident group tried to emerge out of the working class elements and organize something to disrupt the power that and this was all Republican Party, through the public sector, they could be effectively blackballed and be cast out of the social and economic network that would allow them to function. This is disrupted, beginning probably as early as the 20s, although you can't see it, but certainly by the 30s, you can feel the presence of the military. And the military, while it is still racist and is still white, it's different white people who have a different agenda from the Hawley elite that runs Hawaii. And so the United States military doesn't have to pander to a small group of oligarchs in Hawaii. They have a larger mission, and that is to defend or support a Pacific empire. and defended against a growing Japanese threat. So they have, while they're interested in stability, and they have no problem with white folks being in control, their mission and their focus is sometimes at odds with the Hala oligarchy, and it creates an opening wedge for other economic interests, to come to the fore, and the other part of globalization, before I forget, that's coming into play is the spread of commercial interests, where in a relatively sealed Hawaiian economy, the Hale oligarchy can afford to have some parts of the universe operating at less than optimum. That is to say, they can subsidize some of the things that are going on. Where you have growing businesses, Sears is a good example. Sears tried to open a store in Hawaii, and for years it was blocked by the oligarchy because it would threaten the merchandising control that it had. So the Big Five prevented Sears for a very long time, and I can't recall now when it first opened its store, but it could have been the late 30s. But it certainly is trying by the mid 30s to establish an outlet in Hawaii, and it doesn't succeed for quite a long time, even though these are also white-controlled businesses operating from the United States mainland.
So then how, from World War II, where martial law was declared, how did unionization of the plantations occur then?
Well, while the World War II and martial law prohibited union organizing openly, the LWU leadership and were very astute about communicating with community leaders, with labor leaders. Strikes were illegal, but a lot of communication was taking place on each of the plantations. So there was a concerted effort to try to organize without organizing in openly. So there were secret meetings being held. And so it's not an accident that as soon as the war is over, basically, the unions take off. I mean, they as soon as martial law is over in 1944 and it becomes legal to organize again, by 44, 45, not only the docks, but much of the sugar plantations are already organized. So when the 1946 strike takes place, plantations are pretty highly organized.
And one more question before I switch tape. You talked about the San Francisco dock workers wanting to organize the Hawaii dock workers. How then did that, when and why did they translate that to then going into the fields?
I don't know the specifics of how the dock workers take to the fields in terms of organizing, but the logic is pretty clear. The until the 1950s or 1960s even, sugar is the single most important part of the Hawaiian economy. And that's where the largest sector of workers is. That's where the primary strength of the working class movement would be. And so it must have seemed totally logical to move there because this was industrial agriculture and workers were highly concentrated in places that were easy to reach, so they could be organized and mobilized fairly quickly, and they could have shut the Hawaiian economy down pretty quickly.
Okay.